From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in June of 1860 with the publication of the first dime novel. It was called Malayeka, the Indian Wife of the White Hunter. The novel was breezy, sensationalistic, certainly prejudiced, and it helped launch a genre of fiction that would dominate the American media scene for roughly a century. We're talking about old-fashioned westerns, tales of outlaws, mountain men, armed vigilantes, doing battle to protect small frontier towns. The books sold by the millions, the movies were made by the hundreds, and here's why this matters. The authors of a new book about guns in America point to this trend as a kind of fetishization of gunfighting that doesn't actually match the historical record. In their book Beating Guns, authors Shane Claiborne and Michael Martin write that Americans began to worship a version of their own country that never existed, and it included the idea that anyone can become a hero with just a gun and a quick hand and a sense of justice. Well, that's just one small element of their book, which calls for Americans to follow the old idea of turning swords into plows. Claiborne and Martin literally take guns, melt them down, and turn them into garden tools. Or sometimes people turn them into art or other materials. Their book covers a lot of ground, and they write that this should not be a partisan issue. Gun violence affects everyone, of course. And today, they are in Rochester, city number 37 out of 37, on a tour that they have been on, hoping to meet more people who are willing to beat their own guns into garden tools. But first, there are guests for the hour right here on Connections. Shane Claiborne, founder of The Simple Way, president of Red Letter Christians, and co-author of Beating Guns. Welcome, Shane. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. Great to be here.
And also with us is Michael Martin, founder and executive director of Raw Tools, Inc., and co-author of Beating Guns. Mike, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Their event tonight, 6 p.m. at the Greece Baptist Church. Gentlemen, I'll ask you right out of the gate here that you've been in 37 cities, so this is the last one. So yeah. Given what you've experienced, what do you expect to happen tonight at 6 o'clock, and what do you want to happen tonight at 6 o'clock?
Yeah, well, we're going to do what we've done every night. We're going to take a gun, usually donated from this city, from this neighborhood that we're in, and transform it into a garden tool. We love to dedicate those to folks doing really beautiful redemptive work or community gardens locally. But it's also about amplifying the voices of people who have been directly impacted. We really believe in making gun violence personal. And we've had survivors of mass shootings, folks that have lost their kids, even folks that have used a gun to take someone else's life, that have taken the hammer and beat on that red hot metal and been a part of participating in that transformation.
Can you guys tell us what I'm looking at right here on the table? Because our listeners obviously can't see it, but I want you to describe these two tools that are sitting here in our studio.
Yeah, there are two tools that Shane and I have made together at kind of the first event that we did when we about 6 years ago. It's a Matic. It has a fork on one side and a hoe on the other. Both are similar styles. One's made from a handgun found in a Philly abandoned house, and the other's made from an AR-15 that was also from the streets of Philly that we did at an event earlier this year before we kicked off this 37-city tour. So we go from semi-automatic to Matic with these tools.
You know, when the first email came in describing your work, describing your book, the idea of beating guns into plows or beating guns into tools, you know, the idea of swords into plows and doing it with guns, I did think when I first read the email it was symbolic. I did not realize you're actually physically doing it. Mm-hmm. And Mike, Raw Tools, the word raw is war spelled backwards. Tell me about how this first came together.
Well, it was something that has been milling around kind of in a little around since 2010. But then when Sandy Hook happened, that kind of brought the idea and forced us to kind of get off our butts and get to work and learn how to blacksmith so we could do this. It also comes from that swords to plowshare scripture where it also talks about training for war no more and being in fear of no other. And so we use these garden tools and the actual transformation of that metal to make that connection that we need some transformation of our hearts as well and to learn different ways to deal with conflict between each other and within ourselves since suicide is two-thirds of gun violence.
How did the two of you end up together on this project, Shane?
So I had teamed up with a friend of mine, Ben Cohen from Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, and we did an event in Philly called Jesus Bombs and Ice Cream, imagining a world with more ice cream and fewer bombs. You know, so we were talking about the big violence, but we took an AK-47 and we cut it in half and transformed it into garden tools that night. And right after that, I met Mike, and we had this exact same vision of taking donated guns and turning them into tools, talking about violence, creating a better conversation. But this one tool that Mike mentioned that we have with us was really powerful, because at that event was the first time that we invited people who had been impacted by gun violence to take the hammer. And this one mother from Philadelphia, she began pounding on that. And from the depths of her soul, she said, "This is for my boy." She had a picture of her young boy on her jacket there. And so we realized that what we're doing, in one sense, is symbolic, but it's more than symbolic. It's actually giving space for public lament and grief. And over across this country, we've seen Tamir Rice's family, other families that have suffered from tremendous violence, survivors of mass shootings, that when they beat on that metal, there's something that happens to all of us there. And in some ways, it transcends the stale rhetoric of gun control debates and really moves people in their heart and in their gut.
There's a physical transformation of the gun. You're looking for a transformation of the way we look at gun violence in this country. So I know there are some parallels there, but I do want to ask you two things about your shirts and about the tools themselves. Let me start with the shirts. You're both wearing shirts that are indicative of the notion of beating swords into tools. But at first glance, if I were walking down the street and I saw Mike, the first thing I would see is a gun. It would take me a moment to look and say, "Oh, there's a flower grown out. I think there's a flower grown out of that gun." Same way with Shane. If I saw your shirt, I'd see a couple of guns, and then I would say, "Oh, there's something coming out of them." Do people stop you and say, either misunderstanding the shirts or asking you questions? Does that happen?
I get a lot of "I love your shirts."
Yeah.
Where can I get one? Kind of thing. But there is a little bit of that study going. You can see they're trying to figure out, what is this shirt really trying to say. And I think that kind of speaks to the dialogue that we're trying to create as well, that, you know, it's not just this easy message to get. You got to kind of dissect it a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've had a lot of gun owners come out. And one of the things that we found in our book is that an overwhelming majority of gun owners want to see some sensible changes. And so we, things like background checks and assault weapons not being readily available and domestic abusers not being able to get guns, those sort of things. So, like, we've had gun owners come with shirts that say "gun owners against gun violence" or "hunters against assault weapons." And one of those groups, they said on the back of the shirt, it said, "You don't need 10 rounds to kill a deer." And so I think what we're seeing is a really new conversation that's starting. I grew up with guns. I grew up in East Tennessee. But owning a gun for hunting doesn't mean that we believe that AR-15 should be on the streets of Philadelphia or Rochester.
And so when people see the actual tools, they see that you've done it. And I'm not even talking about seeing you actually, you know, do the blacksmithing and the actual process. But when you just walked into the studio and you said, "Yeah, this used to be, what, an AR-15?
Mm-hmm.
That catches your attention. What are the kind of reactions you get around the country when you do that?
Yeah, it's very similar. And then you can tell them, "Well, I can make four of these out in AR-15. We make one gun every 3 seconds in this country, in our gun industry. And so we can kind of flip that on its head, say, well, we can make at least 3 guns on average out of every gun that is donated to us. And so there's kind of opens up your imagination that, oh, we can do something else with the resources we're given.
I think as we traveled around, this has become more and more personal, and we see the nuances and the dynamics of gun violence. Like when we were in Texas, there were a lot of military folks, and they reminded us that the number one cause of death of military service members is not combat, but suicide. They're dying by their own guns more often than, you know, enemy combatant guns. And so there were a ton of folks that surrendered their weapons and beat on those with, you know, tears rolling down their face for fellow service members that took their own lives. One gun that we had, the last time it was fired, was a military service member taking their life, and their friends and family were there. We had another family that a murder-suicide, a man took his life and his wife's life, and then the family was left with a house full of guns. So it really is moving, and, you know, we're not out just kind of going, "Hey, we just want everybody's guns, you got to give them over," but we're stirring, I think, a conversation, and we're moving people's hearts. We've literally had folks during our event go home, get their handguns, and bring them back and say, "You know what, I really don't want this in my house. I think it's more likely that it's going to hurt someone I love than it would actually protect my family."
So let me be honest about what I expected to find in the book versus what I found, because I think this will be valuable for our listeners to understand, because the book's out now. You can find Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence, our guest's book. my first thought was, this will probably be really hopeful, really profoundly loving, a little granola, a little hippy-dippy. And I hope you guys understand that I'm opening up about the prejudice I had about the book going in. The book is so much more comprehensive. And there are personal stories. There is history. I mentioned the history of just understanding the Western and the way we sort of fetishize guns as sort of protective agents, even though that's not really based on what the West was really like, which was interesting for me. There's also really poignant, and I so much appreciate just listing names of people who have died, whether it's Vegas or Parkland or otherwise. And there are sections on policy. There's sections on statistics, because Shane just mentioned the idea of someone handing over to a gun saying, I'm not sure I even feel safe with this at home anymore. Well, your book has statistical information about just how safe or less safe people are with guns in their home. So it was so much more comprehensive than I thought. So I'd like to apologize to you guys for prejudging the book, if I could. And again, listeners, if you want to meet them tonight, 6 o'clock at the Grease Baptist Church. But now that we're going to get into some of the specific points in the book, let me at least ask a couple of pretty direct questions, because there are some new ideas here for me. There's also a lot of well-trod territory, and I'm not sure that hardly anybody's been able to move the needle. Why do you think either one of you or your book together can actually make change in a country where gun debate has been so stagnant?
We're starting by saying, when people are so divided and they say this is not a gun problem, it's a heart problem, our starting point is this is both a gun problem and a heart problem. And there's no law that is going to heal a racist or hate-filled heart. On the other hand, there are some things that are designed to kill, and they make our capacity to destroy life unbelievable. And we saw, as we started this tour, the tragedy in New Zealand. And for several nights, we beat on the barrel of the gun, I think it was 31 times for the number of people who were killed in New Zealand. And then 51 times maybe, yeah, it was. And so then after that, as we saw the story unfold, that country rose up, mm-hmm, and they did something concrete about assault weapons. But they also did not ignore the hatred and the Islamophobia that was specifically targeted in that attack at Muslims. So they're working on both those, and that's exactly what we're doing. And we don't think that there's one magic solution, though I do think that we believe that we can do better at protecting life than we are right now, when 109 lives are lost every day. But there's things even like technology that I hadn't thought about. You know, we got smartphones, we got ATMs that work off of a fingerprint, we've got security systems. Why can't we have smart guns that, you know, if they're stolen, a gun stolen every minute, then it wouldn't be as easy to operate, or someone, a kid finding a gun, or someone that's trying to take their own life, it would make it a lot harder. So it's not just about legislation, but it's going, more than being anti-gun, how can we be anti-gun violence and pro-life? And are there ways that we could do better at protecting life than protecting guns? That's the question we're asking.
Okay, Mike?
Yeah, I think just like with the feeling of how you felt about the book before you read it, every one of us has those types of stereotypes towards each other's, and where we think that this person might be on this topic of gun violence. And I think we all have to deal with our own misperceptions of each other, and that we're really a lot closer and not so spread apart as maybe national media might give us that perception. And even with myself, that the person who taught us how to blacksmith to do this was a gun owner. And we've kind of drifted towards each other a little bit because we're listening to each other's stories. And when you find out that somebody's daughter had been attacked by their partner, that kind of moves you into, what can I do to protect my daughter? And I think there's an illusion that guns give us extra safety or freedom or the ability to protect ourselves and the ones we love in the worst of moments. And like we say in our book, that there's a lot of statistics out there that say we're not safer with that gun in our home. In fact, it's more likely to be used against ourselves and suicide or someone we love. And that even home invasion happens by folks who live within a mile or two of your home. So it's really about loving our neighbors and loving our enemies and learning how to do that better than what we are now. And we do make policy We like to say, you know, God does heal our hearts, but people make policy. And I come from Colorado, where a red flag or extreme risk law was just passed in my county. Before that, that was signed by our governor, passed a Second Amendment sanctuary law. So we can move fast when we want to, but we're just better, and many areas are better at protecting guns than people in this country.
On the subject of hearts versus guns, or is it a hearts problem versus a guns problem? Already, here's Roy listening on Twitter, who writes to us and says, both of the tools that your guest made would be deadly in the wrong hands. Conversely, an AR-15 is not dangerous when used safely and responsibly. We need to focus on people and not tools.
Yeah, I think the common thing there, the design of both of these tools is inherently different. These are designed to dig in the garden, and I'm not going to kill 50 people in 1 minute with my garden tool, but I have that capacity with an AR-15. So we can't generalize it as just all tools are the same, because they're not. Otherwise, I'd be using the wrong types of hammers out there on the anvil. And so that really makes a difference, because all laws are different as well. And we can have a comprehensive approach to this.
Okay.
Yeah,
sure.
I think about cars. You know, cars are not designed to kill, but they sure can. And as automobile technology has changed and made it, you know, cars go faster, and we've allowed our policies to change so that there's speed limits, there's a driving test you have to pass, inspections. You know, if you use a car irresponsibly, you lose your license, you can't drink and drive, all those kind of things that are all designed to protect life, along with technology, airbags, things like that, you know. So on certain technologies, we've been pretty good at evolving and creating regulations that are designed to protect life. One of the most immune industries in the entire country to this has been guns. As the technology has become more and more lethal, our laws have really not changed at all. When the Second Amendment was written, guns fired maybe one or two rounds a minute. Now they fire 100 rounds a minute. Now, bump stocks, I mean, we're starting to get there. But I think, you know, when we start thinking about this technology, which is designed to kill, the question becomes, could we do a better job at protecting life?
So here's one part of the argument that I'm not sure your book has. I don't know how I feel about this, but I want to get your perspective on this, because this is the part that I think is the hardest part of this conversation in this country. A lot of people look at New Zealand, what just happened, how fast New Zealand acted. A lot of people look at Australia 20 plus years ago, what Australia did. But they had very different populations of gun ownership to begin with. We have the more guns per capita, what, than anybody ever? And as you said, a new gun every 3 seconds is produced?
Almost half the world's guns in this country, and we have about 5% of the world's population.
Okay, so this is what I'm trying to understand. I feel like no good faith conversation on guns can happen unless we do two things. We acknowledge, number one, that if you're starting from scratch and you're building a country and you don't have guns, if you introduce guns, even with safe gun ownership laws, the presence of guns themselves will lead to higher rates of gun death than in countries that outlaw guns. That's it. If you have more guns physically in your country, you will have more gun death, more suicide, more interpersonal violence, more occasional deadly mass shootings. And that's what we have. We have more guns and we have more gun death. You can't regulate your way away from that. If you have more guns, you will have more gun death. That's very easily tracked. It's been studied extensively. It is true. And that what frustrates me is when gun owners don't acknowledge that. That is just true. However, we've never had a situation where any country has had this many guns and then tried to either regulate or, through personal decision-making, gone in a direction where you reduce the amount of guns. And we have so many guns, by some counts, 200 to 300 million plus guns in this country, that is the toothpaste out of the tube. Do we need to try to find a way to live with them somehow, because we are so far gone? I mean, as optimistic as both of you are, is this experiment untenable in this country where there's more guns than anywhere else?
No, I think one of the things that just in writing the book that we gave us a lot of hope is, you know, that 5% of gun owners are, or the 5 million gun owners that are part of the NRA, means that there's a lot more that are not. There's a 5% of the gun owners are a part of the NRA. So there's a lot of people who are not part of the NRA that are gun owners. And so there's a lot of spots to walk that back, but also that the young people and the change that does, there's a tide changing here for policy change, but also just in the conversations that we had, that it's not as big a deal for young people to buy guns anymore. So I do see a tide changing, and that divestment from gun industry is one major way to do that without policy, that we don't have to invest there. We don't have to put our money in that place. And that even, you know, you can say that a dog is a better way to defend your home than a gun. And there's stats that prove that as well. So there's a way to divest from the gun industry, even though it feels we've gone so far into it. It feels like it's consuming us. 60% of homes don't have guns in them.
Yeah. So before every social movement that has changed the world, everybody said it's impossible. And after every movement, people look back and go, that was inevitable. You know, I mean, same with slavery. So I think, like, it does look impossible right now to have a country that we have began to decrease gun violence. But I'm convinced that as we look at Parkland, the Black Lives Matter movement, other movements of young people, they are not accepting things, the status quo as things are, you know, and the politicians have not moved, but they're going to move when people move. And even things like a limit to the number of handguns, right? So you go, no one's trying to take away the Second Amendment. We're just saying one person could have a limit of 12 handguns a year, one handgun a month. You know, I think most people go, yeah, if you're getting more than 12 handguns in a year, you're probably not making our country safer. So I think it's finding that common ground where we could go, yeah, without no one's coming after your hunting rifles, but do we really need guns that can fire 100 rounds in a minute any more than we need grenades? Who needs a silencer on their guns? If you're on a no-fly list, should you maybe be on a no-gun list? And those are the places I find a lot of people meeting and going, yeah, we can do better.
I agree. There was the part of your book where you're kind of talking about some of these ideas, particularly the question of how many guns people own. Gary writes to the program and says, there are more guns in this country, yet a smaller percentage of population are now owners. More guns, but owned by fewer people. Mm-hmm. So it's a high concentration in a slowly shrinking number of people that own guns in this country. And when you sort of prompt us to think about, look, if someone says, I want a gun to protect my family, but then they say, I want 100 guns to protect my family. What are you doing with 100 guns?
Yeah, exactly. In Colorado, where Mike is, there's a guy that owns over 4,000 guns. Now, that's extreme, but there actually are a lot of people that own 50 guns or 100 guns. And you start to think, like, the actual statistic is 3% of our population has almost half of the guns, 150 million guns. So that's there's a very small group that are kind of beyond gun owners. They're kind of gun extremists in the sense that I need enough guns that if my government comes for me, I'm going to take them on. And they call themselves patriots. And I think that's a group that becomes less and it seems more and more out of touch with the average gun owner. I mean, a lot of my family that own guns for hunting, they don't think that we need, you know, 50 guns. They got a couple of rifles that they use. And that's why, you know, when Mike says, when the NRA says we've got 5 million members, we also have to hear that means 90% of gun owners are not a part of the mm-hmm. NRA and the ideology that backs it. Over half of gun owners say that they think the NRA misrepresents the narrative of gun owners in America. So that's a big deal. Now, they do own a lot of politicians, but that's changing too, I think, the NRA.
Our guests are the co-authors of Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence, Shane Claiborne and Michael Martin in studio with us. They are on the final stop of a 37-city tour, and their event tonight is at 6 p.m. at the Greece Baptist Church on Long Pond, I think. 6 p.m. at the Greece Baptist Church. They literally will show you and will show you how they melt down, beat an actual gun into a garden tool. And if you missed it earlier, I'm looking at two tools sitting on this table. Again, Mike, why don't you tell us what those tools are for people who missed it, that used to be what? One was a handgun, one was an AR-15?
Right, yeah. And so we take the barrels and we beat them into each a multi-purpose tool that we call a mattock. So it's got a fork on one side and a hoe on the other, or a plow and pruning hooks, like the scripture says. And it really takes this transition of sorts to plowshares and turns semi-automatic to matic, and that's the direction we want to move towards, you know, from standing your ground to sowing your ground and investing in your community and learning who your neighbors are and what their needs are and how we can help each other instead of how can we protect each other, that when we see someone walking down our streets, we're welcoming them with opening arms instead of bearing arms. We're not locking our doors, but we're asking how can we help.
Who do you hope shows up tonight at 6 p.m.? At the Grace Baptist Church.
We hope folks, just as guns don't discriminate, I mean, they kill Republicans and Democrats, old people, young people, people of all different colors of skin and religion. We invite anyone to come tonight. And the beautiful thing about meeting at the Forge is we invite anyone that wants to take the hammer. And we've had police officers and military folks and young kids and grandmothers all join at the Forge.
All right, 6 o'clock tonight. After our only break of the hour, listeners, if you want to call the program, I'm very curious to know, are you a gun owner or a former gun owner? And would you ever hand over your firearm to be melted down, to be turned into a garden tool? Is that the kind of thing that you would do? Have you thought about that? Have you thought about giving up a weapon in your home? Or maybe you are a gun owner and maybe you disagree, or maybe you want to share thoughts. Our listeners here, our guests here, have made it clear in their book and in their work around this country that they do not seek to create a partisan debate, that gun violence touches everybody, and that with their own background, working with people from all types of backgrounds, they want to talk it out. So if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. Your feedback, and as when we come back with the authors of Beating Guns, we're going to talk about their work in faith and the connection they see at times between guns and Christianity. That's next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, a conversation about something called revenge porn and the effort on New York State's behalf to ban it. We're talking about sensitive and sometimes pornographic images and who has a right to distribute them. Then in our second hour, an effort to increase diversity in STEM fields. Talk with you Friday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to grab a phone call as we come back from break with our guests, Shane Claiborne and Michael Martin, who are the co-authors of Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence. Ryan in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Ryan. Hi, Ryan. Are you there?
Hi. How are you doing?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to add that I'm Christian, and I still believe that gun rights are sacred, and it's a part of our history, and it's a part of our heritage, and it's outlined in the Constitution.
Okay. Do you have more you want to say on that?
No, I just want to say that there's young people out here that still believe that gun rights are important. We're not all just going to give our guns away to the government or to any institution or private organization that wants to melt down guns. Not everyone's just going to give up on this country and give away their guns and their freedom.
I'm with you there. I hear you. I know you're certainly right that there are people who would be very hesitant to do that. So if you don't mind, let's talk a little through that. And Shane and Mike probably have some things they want to talk. I'm really glad you called. So stay on the line. Go ahead, Shane. You want to start?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we sure aren't saying that we should just cut the Second Amendment out of the Constitution. But the it is interesting that James Madison, one of the writers of the Second Amendment, he said that liberty can be endangered by the abuse of power, but it can also be endangered by the abuse of liberty. So when one person's rights begin to infringe on another person's pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then we begin to see this collision. And so the evolution of the constitutional rights is an interesting one, because guns are doing something very different now than when they shot one round a minute. And, you know, a lot of our laws were written in a certain context where at the time Dred Scott passed, where it said that black folks don't have rights that white people are obliged to recognize. So as we continue to look at our society, The starting point for me as a Christian, and it sounded like our caller was also a Christian, is that for those of us that are claim to follow Jesus, we have a higher authority than the Constitution, and that's actually Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount and the Scripture. And when Jesus says, love your enemy, it becomes very difficult to reconcile simultaneously preparing to kill your enemy. And so I think we live within that tension where we have a Christ, who we remember this week, suffered tremendous violence and yet did that with forgiveness and grace on his lips. And we celebrate that during the season of Easter. So what does that mean for Christians? And for me, Evan, it breaks my heart that one of the things we found as we read our book is that Christians in America own guns at a higher rate than the general population. And so we're not even saying, you know, a Christian can't own a gun. But when you have guns that are like inscribed with Bible verses, when we have a Bible cover here that looks like it's meant to carry a Bible, but it's actually a gun case. And we have folks telling people to bring guns to church. I think we see this collision, you know, that the cross of Jesus and the gun offer us two very different versions of power. And so it goes to some of the very core of our faith beliefs as Christians.
Yeah, Ryan, what I hear is Shane saying he doesn't want, they don't want to rip up all gun rights. They want something where there's common ground. So, for example, you can own guns, but are you willing to put a limit on how many guns you own? That kind of a question. Do you think there's common ground you can find there, Ryan?
I think there's some common ground if people that would like to see that gun rights are severely diminished to one round shotgun, so that's the only gun that they're going to be able to use.
But nobody said that. I mean, like, well, hold on.
But that's the slippery slope that people that are trying to take guns away are pushing for.
But
we all know it.
No.
We day on the news. We read the articles.
No.
We hear it on your program. We hear it on NPR all day.
So Ryan, I want to respect the concern of a slippery slope, but also say that I think that is way too frequently invoked that shuts down any effort to find common ground. I don't hear Mike and Shane coming in here saying we want a government confiscation of all guns tomorrow or ever. I hear them saying that there has to be a different way than saying very little regulation of unlimited gun ownership in a country that has half the world's guns but 5% of the world's population and a huge percentage of the world's gun violence. And so if your concern is a slippery slope, look, I mean, I want to say I respect that, but then it means that you don't want to listen to any policy proposal. And then how do you find any common ground? So why don't you tell our guests one area where you think, yeah, we can take a step toward more regulation, somewhere where you think it would be fair?
I don't believe that we should be regulating people's freedoms. People that are very adamant about gay rights don't believe that they should give up a certain percentage of their freedom on their push for more gay rights and inclusiveness.
Yeah, but being gay can't kill 50 people in a theater. You know what I mean? No? Okay, well, listen, Ryan, I want to tell you, I'm really glad you called, and I want to turn this over to Mike now. Thank you for the phone call, Ryan. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think one of the problems, especially with policy, is that it's so different from state to state, that we might have a background check requirement on a federal level for all licensed dealers, but as our event in Cleveland realized, you can go onto Arms List and find dozens of AR-15s for sale, meet somebody, have a transaction from trunk of car to trunk of car, no background check. All they need to do is check that you're a resident of the state, and then that AR-15 is yours. And people talk about places like Chicago having really tough gun laws. Well, right across the state line in Gary, Indiana, there's almost none. So, and that's true with a lot of the states that surround Illinois also, so that it's not hard to cross the state line, get what you need, and come back in and kind of skirt all of that red tape. And it's the same reason people in Colorado go to Wyoming or elsewhere to get fireworks for the 4th of July, that there's different inconsistencies from state to state. And I think we need to open up our imagination to say that we can find common ground that is true in all 50 states that kind of help us create a baseline for us to then have better measurements, better data. That's another problem that we have, that the CDC is severely limited on the research and data that it can gather on things that will help us, because this is a public health crisis. We have medical professionals that tell us they can't label gun injuries as accidents because they know there's something that could have been done about it. That's safe gun storage. There's a lot of gun safety that is going unnoticed here that we need to be better at. Like Shane said, a gun is stolen and often loaded from cars and homes every minute in this country. And that's a national average, and it's higher and low in other places. But there's a lot of movement that we can make that is very easy. It should not be hard for us to make these common sense changes that do not infringe whatsoever on the Second Amendment.
But I hear a lack of trust in this caller. You know, Shane, this is someone, Ryan's concerned that if you're successful in making some of these even policy strides, that what's going to then happen is the door opens to full confiscation or something that he perceives down the road. How do you work with that?
Yeah, I mean, I look at other industries, and that hasn't been the case. I mean, but what we saw, like with the tobacco industry, was that tobacco companies blocked any research that might show that tobacco caused cancer, and that's kind of where we're at in a lot of the gun industry.
It's actually a really good parallel.
Is that, you know, we don't even know a lot of things. We don't know the 5% of gun shops that are responsible for most of the crime guns. And so some of this, I think, Evan, is not just an issue of rights, but it's an issue of conscience. And, you know, you look at Dick's Sporting Goods now, and they voluntarily remove guns from their stores because they're like, boy, until we get a better grasp on this, we don't even want to sell guns. And it's going to, I understand, cost them like $150 million, but that was a move of conscience. And I think we need to be able to know who to hold accountable and what will keep people safer and which gun shops are the ones that keep selling to straw buyers, you know, illegally that end up on the streets. And those are the questions that we want to say. And, you know, the thing is about, you know, as we think about faith, is that Christians, and I am a passionate, Jesus-loving Christian, but I saw how narrow we have come to think about what it means to be pro-life in just terms of abortion, that to be pro-life really just means anti-abortion, because for me, being pro-life means caring about gun violence and the death penalty and anything that's destroying people's lives. So I see a lot of Christians that are beginning to see gun violence as an issue of life and death, and every life that is lost is a child made in the image of God, and that matters to God.
Let me get back to your phone calls. James in Rochester, and I'll just say one more time to Ryan, I hope you keep listening, and I hope you know that we're trying to have, and I say on this program because you mentioned NPR and you mentioned the work on this program, we're trying to deal in facts and we're trying to hear all perspectives. So at the very least, Ryan, I'm really glad you called, and I hope that you know that, and I hope that you'll call again at another point. James in Rochester is next. Go ahead, James.
Hi. It's already come up a couple of times, brought up by gun lovers. I believe Ryan was one of them. Whenever this debate comes up, they say, well, it's in the Constitution, the Second Amendment, it's in the Constitution. I just like to point out to these people that the Bill of Rights was not a part of the original Constitution. The Constitution can be amended. That's why we have amendments. And if we think together and work together, we can change the Second Amendment so that it's friendlier to more people. I just get tired of this, you know, it's set in stone kind of mentality, because it isn't.
Yeah.
We have overturned an amendment before. And we have changed the Constitution, 27 times, something like that?
Yeah. So, James, it's a great point. And as I get ready to hand it over to our guests for their thoughts on that, to James's point, think about the history of this country. There have been many occasions where you could go back and find, similar to Ryan's, and I'm not trying to pick on one caller, but what Ryan said was, we're not just going to give up our country. So in his eyes, the notion of almost unregulated gun ownership is part of what it means to be the United States. Well, you could find people who said, we're not just going to give up what it means to have this country and let women vote. We're not going to allow interracial marriage. We're not going to allow same-sex marriage. There's a lot of ideas about what it means to be the United States over time. And it's always a debate about who we are and what we want to be and what our laws represent and what our values are. It will always be changing, or at least sort of moving and debated. It's not a fixed thing. And thank goodness, because the history of discrimination in this country should make all of us glad that it's not a fixed thing. But when Ryan says, well, we're not just going to lose this country, that's why I invoked at the outset the lesson from this book that I had never even thought about, which was sort of the fetishization of guns that came from the Old West novels and movies that isn't really based on an Old West that kind of existed. I mean, some of the notion there are these outlaws that were having these shoot 'em up battles and all the time and saving towns and protecting the women and children doesn't really square with the historical record, but we've put it into our national mythology. So sometimes what we think of as what we are is based on kind of this idea of what we are as opposed to the record. Is that fair, guys?
Yeah, I mean, a great question for all of us would be, where would America be without its guns? Because you almost can't even think about history without recognizing the violence and the role that guns played in massacring natives and subjugating African Americans. So the gun has been an instrument of terror that, you know, has helped to build the America that we have now. And I love to living here and I love my community, but I also think we can't get our future right until we get our history right. And we've got to really recognize that one of our founding sins is violence, especially towards people of color and native lives here. And now as we think of like where that ends up now, I mean, the guns are the number one cause of death of African-American youth. Number one. They're 10 times more likely to die than white kids. Like, so there's a certain legacy of this that has been left. And when you look at the Second Amendment, it has the words well-regulated in it. And it was for state militias that were kind of like a state national guard. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled that that extends to individual rights. But that was only 10 years ago, that ruling. So I think we're still trying to wrestle with how do we build a beautiful country with more guns than people? And what we're seeing in our country is just unprecedented. 9 out of every 10 kids killed in the industrialized world are right here in this one country. And if we care about our kids, then gun violence should matter to us.
Yeah, and more people have died in the last 20 years from domestic gun violence here in the States than in all of America's foreign wars. And if you go back 50 years, then you can include all of America's wars, that we are literally killing ourselves for the sake of the freedom to own that gun. That often, you know, you'll pry that gun out of my cold dead hands. Well, that you're so committed to that individual right to that gun that you would rather die than give up that gun. And so we're really placing that ability to own guns, not even that ability would be taken away, but that your freedom to own a gun more than your freedom to life.
Teresa in Webster writes to us to say, hey, I'm not a gun owner and I wouldn't be, just wanted to address the dismissive tone taken in reference to defending oneself from the government. It seems rational to me. They arrest journalists. Furthermore, the government has unjustly put people on the no-fly list with little recourse for those individuals. So no gun list poses a government overreach threat. I'm just not sure why we would just dismiss out of hand as crazy the idea that the government won't turn on its own people. Guys?
I certainly think that there's plenty of justified suspicion of power and the abuse of power. But what I was kind of critiquing is the idea that an individual or even a small militia group is going to be able to form an armed rebellion that can take on the largest military superpower in the world. So, I mean, our government has bombs that are 80 times the power of Hiroshima. We have the capacity of 50,000 Hiroshima bombs. So I just think the idea that we could create an armed rebellion if our government went haywire is a terrible idea. And as a Christian, I just don't believe in justified violence.
Yeah, I think we have from our inception, a history of solving our problems with violence and using guns as the instrument to pursue that violence. And then, like Shane talked, the big guns make that even more volatile and a harder thing to face. But we really want to open up our imaginations to think about different ways that not only can we engage in this gun violence issue, but also engage in the conflicts that we have with each other, that guns just put us further and further away. If you say that I can hurt somebody with a garden tool, I have to get a lot closer to somebody to do that. And I need to be face to face with that. And a gun just allows me to get further and further away from that. And so do a lot of these data points. And we really need to draw ourselves closer and reimagine how to dialogue and how to think about the realities of our life, that when people want to intrude in our home, that they don't want us to be there as much as we don't want them to be there, that the likelihood of someone intruding and even having a gun on top of that is so small compared to the likelihood of that gun being used against us or someone we love. So just, we really want to provoke our imaginations, think about different ways of solving conflict than prescribe one magic pill that's going to save the world.
All right. In our last few minutes, I want our guests to talk a little bit more about not only their book, but what you can expect tonight at 6 p.m. at the Grace Baptist Church. And obviously, you're hearing two men who come from a faith perspective. I couldn't find it just now, but there's somewhere in the book where you talk about, I think you quote an NRA executive who says that the NRA should be worshipped as a religion, that the NRA is there to protect rights, to protect families, to protect American values, and that it ought to be treated almost like a religion itself. And in some ways, you know, when you look at the adherence and the way we've entrenched on this issue, it feels like changing minds is really tough. Mike, have you seen people who've come to you and they're told you that whether it's the book, the work, the talks that you give have moved any hearts?
Yeah, I think one of the special things that you'll see tonight is when we do gather around the anvil and people who have lost loved ones to gun violence start beating on that gun, that a lot of blacksmiths talk about the steel and the iron ore being the blood of the earth. And for something special happens at that anvil where the blood of the earth meets the blood of the ones we've lost to gun violence. And that's where transforming metal transcends into transforming our hearts. And we see people in the community, that's where people leave the service, go home and get their gun that they want to donate. Maybe not all of their guns, but one of them that they know is a little more dangerous than another. And they bring it back at the end of the service to have a physical change in their life that they've committed, or they engage in other organizations that are there present. We usually have multiple organizations present for people to plug in with, because gun violence intersects with so many different issues that we need to deal with a lot of those issues. So people want to engage and become and support those organizations as well.
Shane, what have you seen?
Yeah, one of the other things that we do is, because it is a heart issue as well, our addiction to violence, our propensity to lash out, that we give these little pieces of paper out that they're called flash paper. It's what magicians use. And people can write the hostilities and fears and of our own hearts, and they burn them at the forge. And it, for us, that's a way of saying, you know, this isn't just about guns. It's about the form that violence takes in our own hearts. And one of the stories we tell is Jesus' own disciple, Peter. When the soldiers come to get Jesus, he picks up his weapon and cuts one of the guy's ears off that comes to arrest Jesus. And Jesus scolds him, Peter, says, put your sword back. You know, you're going to die by the sword if you live by the sword. And then he picks the ear up and heals the guy that Peter wounded. And that story was iconic for the early Christians. They said, when Jesus disarmed Peter, he disarmed every one of us. Because if ever there was a case for standing your ground, you know, for taking up arms to protect the innocent, Peter had the case. But Jesus shows us that for love, we can die, but we cannot kill. And that's what Christians clung to for hundreds of years. That's why you don't ever see them picking up weapons or justifying violence again.
Tonight, 6 p.m. at the Grace Baptist Church. If you want to be there to meet Shane Claiborne, Michael Martin, hear them talk about the work they've been doing, talk about their book, Beating Guns, see the work they've been doing, and you know, we'll see if anybody decides to hand over a firearm tonight. Let me close by asking you, after 37 cities, and this is it, this is the last one, you're going to go home? What are you doing next?
I'm going to see my family a little bit, going to hang out. But Raw Tools does this about once a month across the country when we're not on this kind of 37-city blitz. But so the work will continue for sure. But, yeah, I'm going to take some time with my family.
Yeah, I'm going to go home and rest. But I'm also going home with a forge, and we're going to set up a blacksmithing unit in Philadelphia on the north side of Philly so we can get guns off of our streets. We've seen way too many kids die on our corners.
And where do people find out more about Raw Tools? Again, Mike's with Raw Tools, Inc., and Raw is war backwards. Where do you learn more about that?
You can go to rawtools.org, and you can connect in a variety of ways there, plug into nonviolence resources, or donate your gun as well, or help other folks do the same.
Okay, and Shane, where can people find your work?
They can go to beatingguns.com and find more.
Beatingguns.com. The name of the book, Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence. Shane Claiborne, founder of The Simple Way and president of Red Letter Christians. Michael Martin is the founder and executive director of Raw Tools, Inc., and they are wrapping up 37 cities in Rochester. Thanks for taking some calls from our listeners today. Thanks for engaging with them because, you know, you're not going to find total agreement everywhere you go, but I think the conversation's important. Thank you for doing it.
Absolutely.
Happy to be here.
And listeners, thanks for participating. Again, if you want to meet them tonight, you can do that. And then they're going to go home. Everybody wants to rest a little bit. You know who else is going home? Rob Braden, the engineer. He's earned a little bit of a rest. Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. I've been told not to mention the volunteer's name today because he is the quiet behind-the-scenes guy. But I'm just going to say thank you to all the volunteers of Connections. And we'll talk to you on Friday on Member Supported Public Radio.